the way it's portrayed in the media right now is we look like bullies. It looks very mafia-like. It looks very, and you see the rhetoric back and forth, but I can guarantee you under that rhetoric, there are negotiations happening. Right now, we're not creating stronger companies with this tariff regimen. We're actually creating weaker automobile companies. So what do companies naturally do? They look at every region in North America and say, where can I take high labor content and move it to low labor costs? It does shine a light on the current auto market today. I think only four of the top 15 models in the auto market are final assembled in the U.S. It's one thing to move your manufacturing to the U.S. It's another thing to actually be profitable in doing it.
So we have Jeff Lutz back on the show. Jeff is one of the best voices to follow if you want to understand how the world actually works, especially around supply chain manufacturing and with this craziness in the tariff world going on with the Trump administration, automotive, all kinds of stuff. There's just so much to cover. Now, we're recording this on March 31st. I would like to get this podcast out as soon as possible so that you can get this information before the craziness of April 2nd. And I'm sure after April 2nd, we're going to have a brand new discussion to go through because God knows what the Trump administration is going to do. So Jeff, so walk us through where your head is at now. As Hans was mentioning before we went live, you've been putting out some great content out there on X talking about sort of what you think of these policies, the strategy with the tariffs, especially as somebody who is supportive of the Trump administration, like myself. I think, like Hans said, your opinion holds a specific kind of weight because you are a industry, not just insider, but an industry expert when it comes to supply chain manufacturing and how tariffs can impact it, but also somebody who follows this stuff very closely, right? So give us the lay of the land. Let us know where your head is at right now, and then we'll turn this into a broader discussion.
It's probably one of the more underreported things out there, and just in terms of where the world started in terms of tariffs. And there's this long history. It goes back to the 1800s and even earlier. But I mean, just in terms of where we are today and where the U.S. is today on tariffs, I mean, it's essentially under tariffed. And if you look at tariff and non-tariff barriers, we'll talk a little bit about that. Definitely in a disadvantaged situation. Okay. Now, the question is what do you do about it? And how do you approach it? And I think that's where some of this consternation is coming from. I'm supportive of what the administration is doing. I'm supportive of end state, as I thought I understood it, which would be let's get reciprocal tariffs and let's get to maybe an end state where there's net less tariffing and non-tariff barriers that are out in the world. That's what free trade is. But the way it's portrayed in the media right now is we look like bullies. It looks very mafia-like. It looks very, and you see the rhetoric back and forth, but I can guarantee you under that rhetoric, there are negotiations happening. I don't actually think that they're happening fast enough. There's been this discussion literally before the inauguration, before the election about this. And quite frankly, as soon as the election was done, I think these companies could have started positioning themselves and these countries could have started positioning themselves. And certainly over the last 45 to 60 days, they could have, got this together. And I think we could be in a much better space. But right now, where it stands today is there's confusion. Even if you look at the tariffs as they're written, there's a level of confusion about them. And you can read it from cover to cover and say, well, how would I actually do this? So this is where I think it is today. I think companies, let's start with the auto industry. They saw the tariffs, they saw as they were written last week, then they had to go get into the boardroom and they had to discuss, what does this mean? Starting at the end of our process and the distribution of vehicles now in terms of final assembly, and then moving all the way back in the supply chain. What is this April 3rd announcement? What does it mean? I think that is fairly clear about April 3rd. What's less clear is what happens between April 4th and May 3rd. And that's where I think becomes really treacherous for these companies.
There was a post. So thank you for that. There was a post that Gavin Baker sort of reply to today, and what's interesting is, do you think so let me back up and sort of describe what that post was about. So Gavin was saying Just based on one of the theories that's out there that, hey, a lot of this crazy uncertainty, this like flip-flopping, this weird guidance we're getting from the Trump administration, it's almost like a strategic approach to try and purposefully slow down the economy so that the rates can come down to stimulate back the economy. And with the rates coming down, we can refinance our national debt at a lower interest rate so that we don't have as much interest payments long term. And so a lot of this tariff craziness is a lever that the Trump administration is pulling on purpose. How do you perceive that? Do you think that that's part of the sort of own goal nature of it, that there might be something more underneath, or do you really think this is as simple as the Trump administration is not approaching this in the way that they should? They're not doing a good job just actually coming up with a plan that companies can rely on and make moves confidently with. How do you think about that?
Yeah, I part of this is a poor communication. And part of this is poor execution. Because again, if you go back to Endstate, and Endstate being like, look, these companies have these tariff and non-tariff, these countries have these tariff and non-tariff barriers on us, and it actually drives manufacturing out of our country, and it drives manufacturing into their country, and we're not seeing the benefits of it. We have these trade deficits. We're going to have trade deficits, even in a perfect tariff world, because we have such a strong consumer. But I'm not in the camp of this is 5D chess. I mean, the interest rates have only come down 0.5%. This is a lot of noise. You've taken trillions of dollars, at least temporarily, out of capital markets. You see the biggest gap right now in our S&P index relative, you know, to the European and the Asian indexes. You're starting to, I mean, there's a wealth effect that goes with that as well. So I don't know if this is 5D chess, and the thing I get concerned about is the cabinet leaders are saying slightly different things, and if you're really in tune to what they're saying, you can pick up on it, because you've heard Secretary Bessent talk about getting to net lower tariffs, and that being an end state. And then you hear Secretary Lutnick talking about the External Revenue Service, hear the president talking about that. And they're kind of all saying different things. Navarro's out just in left field, you know, saying American companies aren't even American. It's just the comms are all over the place. The execution appears to be all over the place. And I go back to the example I know with the auto industry. The final assembly thing, I think you're sending a message. I'm mostly supportive of it, by the way, as well. You can talk about the number should it be 25% or 15%. That's fine. But I think there's logic to that, and I think that logic will bring a broader supply chain around the more of that final assembly moving back. But these companies need time to transform product lines and transform how they do the work. So I would do the components on more of a schedule, meaning you are going to get tariffed. We are going to start with a smaller number, but we're going to give you time to re-engineer your products or to engineer new products and to get you in. So when you bring the supply chain back to the U.S., you actually build a product that you're viable, that's profitable, and something that you can eventually export when we figure all this tariff mess out and start bringing the barriers down. Right now, we're not creating stronger companies with this tariff regimen. We're actually creating weaker automobile companies, because it's very simple. Right now, these transmissions and engines for these companies are going back and forth over the border multiple times, but most of the labor content is happening between $2 and $10 per hour in Mexico. That's what happened with USMCA, and that's what happened with NAFTA prior. So okay, we're going to allow this stuff to come over the border. So what do companies naturally do? They look at every region in North America and say, where can I take high labor content and move it to low labor costs? This is what they do. That informed their automation decisions as well, in terms of what level of capital investment for automation. All this thing works together. You can't turn this on in a 30 or 60 day time frame. So what you're going to have happen is you're going to have final assembly factories in the U.S. that are here today that can't be fed with parts profitably because they have this 25% tariff. So now you're going to start incinerating viable product lines that were final assembled in the U.S. They need a schedule for the component tariffs. I think that's what will happen if cooler heads prevail, but let's see.
So the thought process here then is that there's still a pathway for, so, you know, year one, tariffs go up by 25%. Year two, tariffs go up by 50%. Year three, tariffs go up by 75%. So sort of that sort of idea where it allows the manufacturer to start planning for, you know, potentially moving their full production line over. But because it takes so much time, because there are so many pieces, because there's so much involved, then at least you're giving them some sort of pathway to make that happen, right? So you, in your head, there's still a pathway for them to achieve something like that.
Yeah, I wouldn't do the 25 to be clear on the on the components. I would start it at zero for this quarter, and then I would tack on 5% every quarter. Okay. I mean, that builds very quickly, by the way. That builds very quickly, and they start becoming, you know, non-viable in a couple of quarters in terms of components and profitability. But, you know, it does shine a light on the current auto market today. I think only 4 of the top 15 models in the auto market are final assembled in the U.S. It shows you how much and by the way, people get confused a bit. They look at number of models or they look at number of units that are assembled in, you know, one country or another. The actual key metric is the percent of content and the actual value add work that's done. Because right now the metric that's out there is about 50% or 54% of vehicles are final assembled in the U.S. and the other 45% are out of the country. But if you did it on a content basis and the actual labor hours and the opportunity count for labor, it's probably half of that 50%. It's probably 20 to 30%. In terms of content that's done in the U.S. And that really shines a light on what the problem is.
So just
and that's
quick,
what has to be fixed.
Just for the people that might not fully understand that. So tell me if this is a good way of thinking about it. If a car costs $50,000 or say $100,000 to make it easy, just round numbers, or let's say $10,000. If a car costs $10,000 to make, we're saying that only $2,500 of that, maybe $3,000 of that, the U.S. directly has, let's say, control over it, or is benefiting the U.S. economy, whereas the other $7,000 is outside the boundaries of the United States. Is that a good way
of thinking about that? It's even worse than that. Let me explain. Okay. So, and then I'm glad you asked for the clarification because I think it's warranted. So you have number of models, and then you have the models that break down to parts that make the models, okay, the way to think about it. And then those parts have to come together, and there's amount of value add or labor and capital that are required to get that bucket of parts to be a vehicle, okay? What Tesla, here's the stark contrast. What Tesla does is they take the high-value components and the high-value modules, and they do them closer to the factory, closer to the source of supply to their end product. Tesla brings that in and they do it close. The lower dollar parts and the lower value add parts are what they send out. If you look at a conventional ICE vehicle that does a lot of their components that are coming out of Mexico, for example, they'll take the assembly that has the highest amount of labor and CapEx content, and they'll move that to the lowest labor cost region. So it's not
flipped.
Even, it's yeah, yeah.
Flipped.
So what's on the, window sticker, yeah, what's on the window sticker, they call it a Moroni sticker, by the way, I think it's the technical term for it. What's on the sticker is not, it's not percent of part, it's percent of value add, actually. And you can kind of think of that almost on a cost basis. But again, what Tesla and what the legacy auto are doing, it's not only the number of components that are pushed out, the value add on those components or the complexity, the labor content on those components are very high, and it's outside of the country. This is why you've heard the president joke of like, hey, we have these final assembly factories and all they're doing, especially in the case, by the way, of the European auto manufacturers and some of the Japanese, they have these things called knockdown kits. Or they're basically assembled in their home country or another country with lower labor rates, then broken down to the level of the minimum requirements for the U.S. to be marked as final assembled in the U.S., and then they're just reassembled and shipped. We did, by the way, we did knock down kits in the smartphone industry as well.
Wow. So in a knockdown kit, a good way of thinking about this is you know, you put together, I don't know, the interior trim in the car or whatever. You put together the door panels, whatever maximum you can get to, so that when you get it into the United States, the U.S. is like, okay, cool, you did this much to put it together, final assembly. It's similar to like the stickers in the grocery store for meat, where it says product of the USA. Right? I don't know if you ever seen that in the grocery stores. It says product of the USA. That doesn't mean that it's like U.S. meat. It means that the U.S. came to the meat came to the United States and it was processed and packaged in the United States, right? So they might send a whole cow or a giant piece of meat. Then when they slice it up, you know, they check for the QA, they slice it up and then they put it in the package. They can very proudly put product of the USA, but that freaking cow might be from China or from Canada or from El Salvador, whatever, Australia, wherever it might be, right? So it's
right.
Similar thought process. Yeah.
If we bring this back to Tesla and draw a box around it, because I think all the other auto companies have to do this. There's kind of a weird phenomenon happening, and I mean, I know we're bowled up on the name per se, but I mean, you can't escape some of these facts. On the final assembled side, I mean, they're not impacted on final assembly. They're not.
Yeah.
And then if you look at the component tariffs, and there are going to be inbound component tariffs. They have components coming from Asia, for example. They have components that are assembled in Mexico. And this is where the verbiage in the tariff language becomes a little murky. Are these USMCA components? Are they going to grade USMCA components, which are of this current trade agreement we have between Mexico, the US, and Canada? And if that work is done in Mexico, is it going to have a tariff, even though it's part of an existing trade agreement? So that's an open question. But I think things like the AI4 computer, what I've seen of that publicly is, if you look at the, you know, the sticker on the outside of it, there's one that's assembled in Mexico and I've seen one that's assembled in Taiwan. So those are clearly coming in as major. And if you read the tariff, major electronic assemblies, you know, are counted in here. But let's just bring this back for Tesla. Low, zero tariff barrier at the finished assembly, relatively low, a couple of percent maybe at the component level. I mean, those are the facts. So it is correct to say that Tesla is not unscathed in this. It is correct to say. But when you look at it relative to other automakers, it's you know, it's a far cry. But it even gets broader than that. And that's where you get into the design of the supply chain. So if there are retaliatory tariffs, okay, let's say the EU puts a retaliatory tariff on Tesla, okay? Well, Tesla has greater than 90% of their supply chain around the Berlin factory. So they're going to be very well insulated if that occurs. If China does retaliatory, same thing. They're not going to cut off their own noses in this situation. In Shanghai, I believe it's up to 95% localization. China loves that. That's local job. By the way, you could farm a lot of the assembly jobs over the border into Vietnam and get a 30-40% reduction on labor rate by doing that. And Tesla's not doing that at volume or scale. So the second chunk of the Tesla story here is, the first chunk was relatively low impact, U.S. tariffs, zero at the assembly level, very low at the component level. The second chunk of it is the localization story globally. Here's the third chunk of it, ZEV credits. What's going to happen? If you look at the top, ZEV credits are not a U.S. thing, by the way, only. It's a global thing. It's a Canada thing. It's a Europe thing. Just look at the U.S., for example. Of the top 10 EV models sold in the U.S., 1, 2, and basically 3 or 4 are, you know, the Model Y, the Model 3, and the Cybertruck. But 3 of the other top 10 vehicles are Model Y-like vehicles not assembled in the United States. Hyundai Ioniq, Chevy Equinox, Mexico, and Ford Mach-E, Mexico. So the next three of that top 10 are going to get hit, and they may get obliterated in this 25% tariff. I mean, they may take their production down. They may, you know, try to wait this out. We know what's going to happen. What's going to happen if they're not in production? They got to buy more ZEV credits. So that's the other piece of this that's going to play out. Same thing for the European automakers. Volkswagen. Right now, there is Volkswagen assembly that's occurring for their EVs in the United States, but very, very low content in the U.S. That's going to get hit as well. So if they can't make EVs, they're going to have to go buy ZEV credits. So there's a ZEV credit story that could be playing out in the background as well for Tesla. And finally, even just kind of stitch with that story, the $7,500 federal credit is still on. So April 4th hits, you can, for 95% of what Tesla ships in the U.S., it's still eligible for $7,500 credit. There's no tariff on the final assembly. There's a tariff on the final assembly, but it's all done here. Other companies have to take their production down because they do a lot of this, because EVs, they're not profitable on EVs. They push a lot of the component and the final assembly out of the U.S. and try to bring it in. So now they got to go buy more ZEV credits. And then finally, you put the wrapper on the whole thing. If they're building less product, there could be, you know, there's more share for Tesla as long as the auto market doesn't take an overall dip, you know, in consumer confidence. You know, with these tariffs going on, that is a risk. But guess what? If that risk occurs and more of the transit moves to rideshare, what's Tesla waiting there in the wings? And you know, Q3 and Q4, robotaxi. Great.
Man, unbelievable positioning. Go ahead, Hans.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I can't help but reflect on is just how smart Tesla looks right now, having decided not to proceed rapidly with the Gigafactory in Mexico over the last few years. And I mean, what do you think this signals as far as the conversations that Elon Musk was included in? Like, how did they position themselves so well for this moment without some side of insider information?
They didn't need it. And these are decisions that were made 5 and 7, even before the Mexico decision. The localization decision is a company strategy. That's, you know, from the CEO down, it's like, look, because there are globalization plays on components where you can source a lot of stuff from China a lot cheaper. Okay. There's things that they could have done, but they didn't do it. And if I were in their position, and I advise companies on this as well, I would have done what Tesla is doing. I'm very aligned with their approach. The geopolitical aspect, forget about tariffs, just the kinetic, you know, from a war perspective, it's important for have your supply localized on all continents. And then now you overlay the geopolitical economic, you know, issue with, you know, if you saw the election coming up and you know what Trump has called himself, the tariff man, you don't need any inside information to know that you should be localizing supply rapidly. And he was very, in the campaign, he was very clear that we're not going to have this beachhead set up where the Chinese just set up in Mexico and drive cars over the border. That's just not going to happen. And I predicted that would not happen. That would just destroy the U.S. auto industry. So you didn't need to be in any inside conversations, quite frankly. And these things are decisions that Tesla made 5, 6, 7 years ago, and they stuck with it. It's their company culture, and it's now playing out. And by the way, that's why it's also going to take that long for these other companies to actually do this work. It's not going to take everybody. It's not going to take 5 or 7 years for everybody. But it's one thing to move your manufacturing to the U.S. It's another thing to actually be profitable in doing it. And sometimes people don't actually step back and think about it. You have to make a set of decisions around automation, around labor content, and around simplification of your product. You can't. This is why this whole theory of the Chinese are just going to come here, set up manufacturing, and dominate. The Chinese way of assembly on product and the Chinese way of sourcing on product will not economically translate to the United States. It won't work. They're going to have to change what they do. Now, there are companies that are closer to that than others, but there's a very big gap between them. Xiaomi, for one of them, is started on the right track. Low model count, high automation, they have a chance. But if they bring final assembly here, they've got to bring the whole supply chain around it. And that's years of work.
So do you think that there is a forcing function for that, though, for the Chinese automakers to make it into the United States? Because if you think about the current situation, like if you fast forward at 12, 18, 24 months with that beautiful summary that you went through with the the relative cost of a Tesla vehicle versus a legacy automaker is going to be significant. And a lot of that is because of the lack of localization of parts, but also inefficient manufacturing design, et cetera, from those legacy automakers, right? Now there's going to be, essentially, for somebody to be able to buy an affordable vehicle, right, your options are extremely limited. And let's set aside autonomy slightly to the side, too, because that, it's such a crazy time. But isn't there a forcing function for manufacturers, auto manufacturers, to come to the United States that are very good at building cheap cars? And don't the Chinese, even though they're going to have to redo their strategy on how to do that, don't they kind of know how to do it better than legacy automakers? Won't that open the door for the Chinese automakers to come to the States?
They have an advantage on simplification and hardware costs, but it is very difficult for that to translate in the United States with our labor costs, with unions, with everything else out there. So it's not easy for them. A lot of people don't know, for example, I mean, there is Chinese auto manufacturing in the U.S. It's in Lancaster, California. It's BYD buses. And I think it's dozens, you know, it's handfuls, but they are built, they're final assembled, you know, in Lancaster, and they've been doing that for a long time, by the way. But it is a very difficult for them in the way that they approach supply chain. China's supply chain and U.S. supply chain are almost different planets. And I had the pleasure of leading a Lenovo smartphone supply chain and being an executive in that, as well as, you know, U.S. supply chain. And it is just literally night and day. There aren't many examples of them picking up and then planting themselves here and being successful.
Difference just massive cheap labor? Is that the fundamental difference?
Yeah, and it's this. Well, that's part of it, and it's not even the cheapest labor anymore. By the way, there are much cheaper areas of labor. You go to Vietnam, you go to other countries. There's even much cheaper. But now they're moving more and more into automation. And that will give them a chance in Western Europe and the U.S., but it's going to take a series of time for them to do it. And all that automation it's at the OEM level. It hasn't necessarily worked its way down through multiple tiers of the supply chain, but it is. So it's something that could economically happen over time. The question is will the U.S. allow it? From a policy perspective, you still can't buy Huawei or ZTE phones here. They don't manufacture here. By the way, there's no reason why smartphones can't be made here. You'd have to set up the supply chain and the automation to do it. It can't absolutely be done. I've set up a 5 million unit a year, 10 million unit a year supply chain here before. But that's a different story for a different time. But you're going to have an economic burden. And then you're going to have a regulatory burden for that to happen. I'm not saying it's never, but it's not overnight either.
What do you think are the chances that the negotiations between the U.S. and China that are ongoing ends up in some sort of grand bargain that allows Chinese companies to come to the United States and operate in the United States in the same way that Tesla's operating in China? So that and that's how we open the doors. You know, do you think that's a possibility?
Not soon, and here's the reason. The reason is there's a distinct advantage right now in terms of what China has with their supply chain and what they've developed over, you know, more than a decade, and the U.S. knows this. So that if they flip that switch and the U.S. allowed that, I mean, you're basically writing the death warrants for multiple, you know, U.S. So you have a 3 million person labor force in the U.S. that's connected to big auto. It's not only the
union
final assembly plant,
right?
Well, union and non-union too. You have all the supply base. You have a lot of things. You have all the financing arms. You have all these things connected to the U.S. automobile industry. And it's not to say that some of those could not serve Chinese manufacturing as well, but you just have tremendous risk of that happening, because right now, if you look at the product offerings, there's no one in the U.S. The only one in the U.S. that's actually close to being able to match China is Tesla, and that's why Tesla can compete in China. None of the other OEMs would be ready to do And by the way, China wouldn't be, again, China would not be ready today to do that as well. They have to get to a level of labor content that they're just not at across the board. Again, Xiaomi and Zeekr are in a little bit of a different category. I think they are further along, but the others are not.
Yeah. I do wonder how much of this like tariff hoopla, and I know, you know, Trump is on record sort of talking about tariffs and wanted, you know, wanting the United States to be in a better position from a tariffs perspective. I mean, he's there are multiple interviews for the last 20, 30 years where he's talked about it. But I do wonder if a lot of the emergency behind these policies today is rooted in the fact that if we don't do something, China will just soak up the world's manufacturing and supply chain. They just will. Because, you know, if you're allowing them to sell into the United States or other parts of the world with little to no, let's say, like a fair playing, like a fair sort of rule set, I guess, a fair rule set, then the forcing function is just goes directly to it. Because now they've reached a threshold of good enough. Not even good enough, of like good. They've reached a threshold of like, hey, like this stuff is actually pretty good. It's not bad. I mean, yeah. You see all those videos of Chinese automakers. I have a very good friend of mine who's been to China the last multiple times in the last year or so. And he keeps sending me these videos and pictures of the cars they got over there. I'm like, this is crazy. This is crazy. And so you extrapolate their capability in manufacturing vehicles. That's not the only thing they know how to manufacture. They know how to manufacture a lot of things, right? So I do wonder how much of the emergency and the rhetoric is centered around that. Like, hey, like it's now or never. It's now or never. We have to catch up some way. We have to create a forcing function somehow for the United States to build capacity so that we can compete. But like my fear is it's impossible for the U.S. to do that unless they go all in automation. Because we're never going to match the Chinese labor rules. We're never going to match the Chinese culture. We're never going to match the mass of humanity that exists in China, right? So the only way to compete is through automation. Human or robots, yeah. Artificial intelligence, super complex and super advanced manufacturing systems, right? That's the only way to compete.
Yeah, humanoids are the... probably the bridge, but you've got years between where we are today and them operating at speed, velocity, and distribution to be able to do that. And China's not going to sit still as well with their humanoids. Remember, their labor rates are going up as well. So, yes, part of this could be a forcing function. I think people should just rewind back to just even 2017. In 2017, we had a 2.5% tariff on cars made in China coming back here. And China had on us a 17% VAT. And I believe they also had an additional tariff on our vehicles as well. So that was kind of the opening salvo for the Trump administration. Like, hey, we've got to get a tariff on this. Like, this is not fair and equitable trade. And I don't think a lot of people realized where this started. There's a VAT. And this is what people need to start thinking about in terms of tariff barriers and non-tariff barriers. There's a couple of charts out there. We can probably supply them and put them up either or later. But non-tariff barriers are a real thing. And these are things, you think about value-added tax, for example. This is, you know, you can ship a product in. We're going to charge you a 17% VAT, though. And what that means is whatever the value of that product is, tack on 17%. Now,
and just to be clear, just for the audience, so this is not increasing the cost as the product comes into the country. It's you increase the cost when the consumer goes to buy it in your own country, right? That's sort of the thought process. If you allow it to come at the cost, but you put in a tax after it enters the country and it's processed and it's about to be
purchased by the consumer. And you know how you can relieve, like in the China rules, you know how you can relieve the VAT on your product is to source and do more of the transformation in China. So the more and more components that you add to the mix that are local China sourced and local, and then where the value add, it goes from a component to an assembly to the final product, the more of those operations you do in China, those get relieved at the end and they don't count in the VAT. So the VAT's almost like a counter and it starts at that 17%, and they reward you for the more amount of content you bring into the country and do there, and then you can get the VAT relieved. So people need to understand that there's, in the EU has a VAT, it operates a little bit differently. People understand that there's not only tariff barriers, but there's non-tariff barriers. as well in this equation. So yeah, the U.S. had to do something, especially as it relates to what's happening with automobiles. But the lead in China and what they've been able to do with EVs is, honestly, it's played out. You can go all the way back before the first Trump administration, the work that they've been doing on batteries and charging. This is where, you know, BYD and CATL actually started in terms of their core businesses, or where CATL is today, still in batteries. But they weren't. They, at that point in time, even 15 years ago, the Koreans were still the leaders in battery manufacturing. And that's transitioned over the last two decades into China. So this started at the mineral operation, then to the refining operation, and they've been building this out in parallel over two decades. This is why you can't fix this stuff overnight. They have an inherent advantage.
Hans, I saw you came off mute a couple of times. Did you want to jump in?
Well, I was just going to ask Jeff to tell the audience what a VAT was for the people here in the United States who have almost never paid a value-added tax and had no idea what Jeff was talking about. But he did that very well, so I didn't need to do that. One of the things that I can do now, though, is pivot a little bit back to the Gavin Baker post. And one of the things that he said that really jumped out to me was the fact that there's news recently that came out that China, South Korea, and Japan will jointly respond to any tariff actions by the United States. And, you know, he made note of the fact that this is the first time that those three countries have agreed on anything in a very, very, very long time, like long as in measured in hundreds, if not thousands of years. It's very, very difficult to get those three people to agree on anything. And it, to me, one of the things that I took away from that was just a signal that the balance of power has, specifically in the Pacific region, but even really globally ex-US, has definitely changed more over the last few decades than maybe we in the United States have realized or are ready to appreciate. And I think that China has done an incredible job of exercising soft power, not only in the Pacific, but even, you know, here in the Western Hemisphere with places like Mexico and Canada and the United States. And so I was just curious, how does that dynamic play into all of this as far as your concern, and how are you reading those types of signals?
Yeah, so they have to do that. And the reason they have to do that is by themselves, they're totally disadvantaged and they would lose any tariff war, any trade war. They would lose badly. This is the same thing you saw with Canada starting to inch more closely with the EU. By themselves, they're upside down in any, it's an annihilation of trying to do this with the United States. So you're going to see some of this. The U.S. has to hit back pretty hard and say, look, if you do this, you know, there's going to be serious problems for you. But at the same time, the U.S. needs to understand that that threat exists, and they're going to have to be able to work through it. But I think this is where a lot of these things are actually going to start coming together, but it's going to take a series of time. I think the whole thing is a mess, to be honest with you. I think the whole thing is a mess. If you go back to end state and going for reciprocal tariffs, that's fine. I think if you get a proper spokesperson in there, they can explain, like, look, for decades, this is what they did to us. We're going to do the same thing. If they decide to take it off, we'll both take it down. I think that's a very clear story, but that's not how the story is being told. It's very muddy. It's very unclear. And even the tariffs as written are unclear. And so now bringing it back to the boardroom, if you're GM or Ford and you read the tariff announcement from last week, it's not entirely clear if your Mexico components are going to fall under a tariff. It also says in the writing that they have to develop an approach for grading tariffs on components, especially USMCA components. So now you've written a tariff, you put a proclamation out there, and inside the tariff it says, well, we still have further development work to do. So that means these components are still going to just come over the border in the meantime. So we're on the outside of this. Part of this is negotiation, but I'm here to say that not all of this is 5D chess. And if enacted the way it's described, both sides of this know, Mexico knows, for example, Canada knows, that this would be highly destructive to the incumbents, the incumbent automakers in the United States. Highly destructive if implemented the way that they're implemented now. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. The targets are moving. Is it fentanyl? Is it not? Is it border crossings? Is it not? You know, is it tariff barriers, non-tariff barriers, or isn't? So I don't know if that's part of the negotiation to be have everything be this cloud that follows the administration. But, you know, I've been supportive, but at the same time, I think there's a real opportunity here. And I think the April 2nd thing, by the way, I think it's going to be more of a buy the news kind of thing, I hope. But we'll see. And I also think that you're still going to they have a history of keeping things vague. I think it's still going to be vague beyond April 2nd. That's a little bit of a problem. That goes back to, okay, what do you do now if you're in the boardroom? Which investment decisions do you make? Which product lines do you deprecate? Which product lines do you move? Which product lines have to be redesigned? What do I say to my shareholders in terms of what my sales are going to do this year? Like, how do I... So right now, they've got to put a box around this. They've got to start with the April 3rd tariffs, and they have to say what that impact is. But right behind it is the box for the components. And I would say, okay, what's the peak impact of that? And then what's our plan?
So your super duper official prediction then for April 2nd is hopefully softer than harsher, and hopefully something that companies can start legitimately planning towards. Is that a fair?
Yeah. More clarity, but not actually clear.
Yeah,
not more full clarity. Yeah,
not full clarity. Okay, wild. No, you're good. I mean, it's like, and that's why this is such a fun discussion, because, you know, we'll put your prediction out there and we'll see what happens.